You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel HaLevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Okay, shalom to everyone. Today is the 26th of November 2017, and I am almost off to my thesis paper, so I am cool as a cucumber now, just a little tired. And the matter at hand today, and it's kind of interesting that I kind of came across an article that I've seen before, and it came up again today when I was reading some stuff regarding keeping the feasts and identity and stuff like that. And I was kind of looking at this article that came out in Mosaic, and those who are friends of mine on my private Facebook know this, that I'm sometimes very vocal about identity and everything, especially because I took courses that deal with identity and the erosion of Jewish identity and Torah identity and so on. And I deal with a lot of people from all over the world that are seeking a Torah-based identity. So there's always this leaking into a lot of different subjects of identity and so on. And the thing that I always hate saying, and when you get through this, you understand how this all connects. And I always hate saying this, but being an Israelite, being a Jew, is more about loyalty than anything else. If you take the example of Kalev and his brother, what was his name now? I can't remember his name right now. And you take different characters who are loyal to the God of Israel, like Ruth, Kalev, and others. And today we're going to dip a little bit into Isaiah as well, so I hope you get excited about that as well. And the thing that really hits the nail over the head is the fact that loyalty is the number one factor throughout the entire Tanakh, by the way, is the number one factor in being an Israelite. It starts with Abraham, it starts with Avraham, who shows loyalty to God by fulfilling the different things that were combined upon him. It flows into Jacob, and this week's parasha, Vayishlach, deals with keeping promises and being loyal. Last parasha, Vayetze, Yaakov does a deal with God, and he says, if you provide me everything that I need, I will be loyal to you, and I will do this, and I will do that. And one of the things that he has to do is he goes to Beit El, and he has to go back to Beit El and build an altar there and build a house for God there. Really, house is not necessarily just a house, but basically a place of worship. Remember that there's sometimes terminology that's more, either archaic or idiomatic. A house of God can also be a place where a person just goes to worship. It doesn't necessarily have to be an actual house. And the thing that basically comes out of all of this is the fact that loyalty is the number one thing. There's even a midrash that goes into the whole idea of why did Yaakov have to go through the whole story of Dinah. I think part of it is also kind of like a criticism of the Canaanite society, but it also, they do a whole thing of what's called smichut parshiot, the closeness of different parts of the Torah to one another, that kind of indicates some of the principles of why certain things happen, like circumstances of things. So the whole idea of linking stories to one another by using similar words and stuff like that. However, the fact is that everyone has to be loyal, and being loyal is the number one factor in basically being Torah observant. And the problem is that when people are abusing their Jewish identity, claim, oh, I'm a Jew and I'm whatever, and I understand it this way, that's basically what we can call the abuse of the Jew card, the card thing. I once heard from a guy from Asia, so he says, the Asian card. So kind of like the Jew card, because it really is a fact that people don't understand that the fact that you have a certain heritage or something doesn't automatically make you an expert. even going to Hebrew school or something suddenly makes these people experts in everything. But truth, to be an expert in Torah, you actually have to study Torah. You actually have to take the time to be in Torah and also be involved in everything, but more so to be loyal to the principles. And that's really the main thing. So being loyal is divided into, I would say, probably two basic acts. The first act is the private act. The private act is keeping Torah in your home, being loyal to Torah at your home, the things that others don't get to see, if you're eating clean or not, if you're eating kosher, as we would say, or if the person is keeping the different commandments, nida, anything which is in the privacy of the home. That's number one. Now, the thing about certain types of Jews from around the world is that they actually followed this principle founded by Moses Mendelssohn, who was a Jew who lived in the 1700s, who kind of started this intellectual movement in Germany. He is accused of being the first Reformed Jew. It's not really him. That was really someone else a little bit after him. But in any case, he's kind of blamed for saying the following thing, which is actually he did say, but it wasn't his intent to remove Torah. His intent was to actually just say, you know, if you want to be involved in German society, you just have to behave like a German. So he said, be a Jew in your house, and a German, or a, not even a German, a person, a human being outside. So he had a minimalist beard, and he didn't dress like the rest of the Jews and so on, and he kept kosher and everything, but he allowed himself to be overly involved in certain things that I myself would be very question very easily. But there's also the public display, and this is the thing that a lot of people today, especially Jews who are trying to be Western, the same way Mendelssohn basically went through, trying to be Western while avoiding the public display of being Jewish. And the public display, the ultimate public display of loyalty to Torah is basically the feasts. That you take time out of your life several times a year. And Torah doesn't overburden us. It's kind of interesting that Torah is not interested in having too many feasts. But what it does is it tells you that there's a minimal amount of feasts that you have to keep, which are part of your identity. But the identity is linked also to the land. All the feasts that we have are linked to the land. Now, we'll get to Shabbat when we actually talk about the text and explain some things there, because some people want to argue that Shabbat is only to be kept in the land. And they do this because they derive the whole idea of the feast being connected to the land. Therefore, Shabbat should be also, because it's also referred to as a Moed inside the biblical text. But for those who've been with me from the beginning, which is most of you here, we've discussed the whole thing of the feast, and we've discussed the whole thing of different feasts. Actually, the first 2 years, I think, we had a whole discussion about them. So we're gonna might repeat certain things. We might cover stuff that I haven't spoken about before. Maybe because I was unaware of them, or because it just wasn't really the point at the time. But now that we're through the text, we're actually going there. We're gonna talk about these things again and focus on some details. So you take Avraham. Avraham is given a promise. The promise has to do with the land. Having land is having identity. If you're disconnected from your land, you don't have identity. So for people who live in the diaspora, they really have to cling to certain things, some symbolic things that will give you identity. For example, in India, there is a group of people who live on the rivers, very similar to the gypsies of France, the ones who travel between France and Germany, and they live on the rivers. They're denied any land. They're basically denied as identity as a social group. They're only given, basically looked upon as a social group that basically are outcasts. And without land, you don't really have a footing. So what happens is that when you remove a person from his property, when you remove a person from his land, he doesn't really have a holding on the earth. What happens is the person has to develop some external practice, external identity that will make him into what he wants to be or is. And the problem that we have is that a large number of Jews around the world are basically living outside of the land, and they developed, you know, for many, many years, being just keeping Torah was the thing that kept you alive. But today they say, you know, we don't really need Torah or anything to be Jewish, which is fundamentally incorrect when it comes to the principle of covenant. So Avraham is given the land. The reason he's given the land is because he is loyal, and this loyalty grants him the closeness to God. You remove this loyalty, you no longer have the closeness to God, and you eventually don't have the right for land, which may explain the spiritual implications of what's going on with some of these Jews in the United States. The feasts themselves are a national expression of loyalty to God. It is not something you do privately in your house. The feasts of Passover, the Chag HaMatzot, actually not Chag HaMatzot yet, the Pesach itself is a national act. You do it together in a temple. Shavuot is a national act. You bring a symbolic sheaf. Sorry, you bring a symbolic sheaf during Chag HaMatzot, and then you bring a symbolic loaves of bread to represent the land that you're on, again representing the covenant. Then Chag HaSukkot, again, everyone has to assemble at the temple. Unlike the rest of the feasts, where it just says you have to do this, you have to do that, in Chag HaSukkot, you have a command to actually show up at the temple. Now, in Deuteronomy, it says all males have to show up 3 times a year. But when you read Exodus and you read Leviticus, you get more of an idea of this being the feast of Chag HaSukkot is the feast. It's HaChag. It's referred to as the feast in the Bible. And it demonstrates the whole idea of having to show up at the temple. The two main themes that go through these feasts are the fact that there's a national representation of the loyalty to God, and the idea of being on the land. The reason these two things come together goes all the way back, as I said a moment ago, to Avraham. Without the principles that we learn from Avraham, you lose the principles of what everything is about. So, for example, if a Bible scholar says to you, well, maybe the stories of Avraham are not true. Even if you argue they're not true, which I strongly disagree with, but even if you argue they're not true, they still represent to us, the stories are educational stories. These are known as deductive stories. They're here to educate you. And the purpose of educating you is to give you a physical description of someone doing certain deeds, acting in a certain way, and then for you, as a descendant of this person, or the so-called descendant of the person, if you're taking the academic approach, you're supposed to imitate them, because storytelling is there to give us not just this is what happened historically. Storytelling is here to tell you how to act. I think basically living by example. That's the basic idea. That even if it wasn't exactly like this, living by example is really what's focused here. So the main principle of the entire feast is the land and loyalty to God. Shabbat, which is the first representation that we have, is in the list, but doesn't share all the parts that the rest of the feasts have. Yom Teruah, Yom HaKippurim, these are more preparation days. So they're not really feasts, but they are, and they kind of fall into a very unusual category. But what they mostly are preparation days. So they're not really linked in the same way. Their link is because they are part of a chain inside between the first two feasts and then the third feast, which is Chag HaSukkot. So the mentioning of Shabbat in the first couple of verses in this chapter really stems from needing to kind of take all the days which are non-work days and put them together. And it stems from identifying the days of covenant. So for example, placing Shabbat in the beginning, I think even emphasizes more the fact that these feasts had to do with covenant. So what are the linking elements between Shabbat and the rest of the feasts? Not that Shabbat is a moed, but linking the idea that Shabbat is part of the larger covenant, and part of the larger covenant is also having days where you don't do work, you dedicate these days to God. Now, Shabbat is also a day of rest. It's linked to the whole story, Genesis 1 and the idea of resting on that day and so on. But I think people in biblical times were very aware, and I say biblical times, I mean, First Temple. They were very, very aware of the fact that that Shabbat is a day that you rest on, but it's also a time for you to go reflect about God. And we have that whole story with the during times of Elisha, and he goes and he has to resurrect the son of the woman that he the Shunammite woman, and the servant says to her, it's not a Sabbath or a new moon. What's very interesting here, by the way, for those who go into the whole polemic of is a new moon a Sabbath or not? The answer is it isn't, because it doesn't really appear anywhere as being a Sabbath, but also the way it's linked together, where the Shabbat itself as a Shabbat is mentioned without the new moon. But the new moon is a celebration day. But the fact is that you're allowed to do work on that day, and it's not really a Shabbat. It can fall on Shabbat. I mean, it's just a fact. And the fact is that people used to have half days on those days. So if you have a half day, I think people just didn't even bother go to the market. So it kind of minimized the amount of work people did in overall. So I think it just became a consensus not to do work, which would explain why Amos, I think it's like Amos 3 or 4, describes as the Shabbat and the Shabbat and the Chodesh will pass. When will the Shabbat and the Chodesh will pass, so we can change the prices of things and steal from everyone and so on. So it really stems from the fact that they treated the day as an important day. But it's not that the day itself that the day of the new moon was really a feast day or anything like that. It was a celebratory day. So, people minimized the amount of work they did, but it was more out of choice than anything else. So in any case, so that's how Shabbat really links to this whole story. And there's also a structural thing in the verses themselves that indicate a separation between Shabbat and the rest of the feasts. There are a lot of academic speculations about the feasts, like you would not believe. I mean, any time you open up any academic book that deals with the feasts, or the book of Leviticus, or anything like that, they'll start speculating until they're blue in the face. Facts remain that the Israelite version of the feasts, in many cases, does not even resemble slightly what was done in other cultures. There are some similarities, but these similarities are mostly superficial. But they do work inside the microcosmos of religious culture in the ancient Near East, but the Torah also has its own understanding of things and so on. So really do yourself a favor and don't get duped by these academic gymnastics, as my dad will call them, when it comes to the feasts or anything in the Torah itself, because there are, in many cases, massive differences. However, it does work inside the scheme of the overall culture. Okay, so with all that said, I will now venture into the text itself. So the text itself now starts basically what we can call, I don't know how to call it, the other half of the book of Leviticus. Basically, we had the book of Temple, scholars like calling P. Now we had H, and now we have, I don't know, P2. I don't know how to call it. It's the whole document hypothesis is just ridiculous. But in any case, the interesting thing here has to do with the statement in verse 2. We'll get to in a second. Says, "Vaydaber Adonai el Moshe lemon." The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Daber el Bnei Yisrael." Speak to the children of Israel. So it's interesting here again. Like I always point out, is that everything is open. Everything is said to the children of Israel. Even things inside the priestly book, which indicates the whole idea of there are no secrets. There is nothing hiding. Nothing's looking in the dark. There's no secret information or anything like that. Everything is in public. Ceremonies, the temple ceremonies are done in public. When the Kohanim go into the temple itself, they know everyone knows exactly what they're doing there and so on. Va'amarta alehem, and you will say to them, alehem refers to the children of Israel, Mo'adei Adonai, and I want to check for a second if this thing is accurate. it should be accurate. Mo'ade Adonai, the appointed times of the Lord. So this is a construct state, Mo'ade of Adonai. It's because it's this is a construct state of the word Mo'adim. The root is Va'ad, which is to show up as a gathering. So it's appointed time, a gathering time. Asher tikru otam mikrei kodesh, which you shall declare them. So it seems to be that there's a need to declare these days as holy days. Mikrei kodesh, holy convocations, holy declarations, but basically you have to make it known that this day is holy. How would they do it? Sounding a shofar, telling everyone. In Judaism today, we do a kiddush. It's basically a vocalization, a literal vocalization of declaring the day holy, which creates liturgy. And the understanding is, I think Israel Knoll, and many other scholars, but Israel Knoll is one of the people I read about this subject, that he basically said that in the temple, and I won't be surprised if Muvenkel pointed this out as well in his massive book that he wrote about the Psalms in Israel, which I recommended this book several times. It's a big, thick book. Not super duper expensive, but not cheap, but worth reading. Again, like any scholar, there's a lot of stuff you can comment about what he says there, but there's some interesting insight there. And they both talk about liturgy. So Knoll, Israel Knoll, and Movenkel, I can't remember his first name right now, they both talk about the idea of liturgy, that in the temple they would have a cycle where a Kohen would recite every day something to do with the creation. Because if you look at the Genesis 1, it's built a lot, there's a lot of repetitive closing on each day and so on, which makes it feel as if there's some kind of liturgy going on there. So a lot of people like taking the beginning of Genesis 1 basically say, oh, this is like almost like a peace source. Well, whatever the idea is, there seems to be an element of liturgy, an element of declaring out loud. So this is why in the synagogues we declare out loud, we recite certain verses of the Shabbat, in the feast always, there's always these types of things. Elehem mu'adai, these are my appointed times. So it starts with Shabbat. Sheshet yamim ta'aseh melacha. 6 days. Okay, sheshet. There's again another way of saying six. There's shesh, there's shisha, and there's also sheshet, which is another form that's used. So sheshet yamim, 6 days. Ta'aseh melacha, you shall do melacha. Melacha, very interesting, comes from the same root as malach. If you actually notice, if you remove the hay, you actually have the word malach. Mem lamed aleph chaf. Melacha, as I've explained many times in the past, is a doing a deed, which is your profession. Not everything that you do is considered to be work. Most of what people would do as work is when it's something. Well, what we considered work on Shabbat is what you do as your profession. Okay? A profession can also be something you do in someone's name, like working someone's field or being a scribe that's been commissioned to write a letter and so on. But it raises the question that what about if someone does someone else's profession, but they're not experts in this? It's not really their profession. Like, for example, someone attempting to write a letter. Would that be considered a type of melacha? Is the melacha affiliated with the idea of doing the actual work, regardless if it's your profession, or is it connected to doing the work specifically to your job? It seems to me, from the description, when it comes to the idea of not working your field, it's a very generalized principle, at least in my opinion, that any form of profession that may exist, even though you're a layman in that profession, would raise questions if you're allowed to do it. The question is, for example, if your job is a teacher and you teach on Shabbat, but you don't get paid for it, is it really considered to be work? So there's interesting borderlines between different situations. So for example, I always have this dilemma myself. Am I allowed to sit down and read something in biblical studies or Hebrew or something like that on Shabbat? Because it also relates to my profession. But the thing is, most of the time I read these types of things mostly for my own needs. So, you know, even if I can utilize it for work, most of it is just me reading as a researcher and so on. So it's probably not a problem for me. And also giving a lecture or giving a teaching during Shabbat, as long as I'm not paid for it, then it's not really an issue. But it's an interesting dilemma. So Rabbinic Judaism, and not even Rabbinic Judaism, not just Rabbinic Judaism, but also the Dead Sea Scrolls, you see the Qumranic community also declaring many things being forbidden on Shabbat. So it's not just a Rabbinic Pharisaic thing. It was something which was pan-Jewish. But you will do 6 days, you'll do your profession, you'll do your work. Uvayom ha-shevi, and on the seventh day, Shabbat Shabbaton Mikra Kodesh. It's referred to as a complete rest. Now, it's interesting because it's usually just Shabbat. And here he uses the term Shabbat Shabbaton, which is a term that's used for Yom HaKippurim as well. So why is he using Shabbat Shabbaton? Chances are that, two possibilities here. First of all, we have to think about the lexical use of words in segments of the Tanakh. I've pointed this out before, that each part of the Tanakh, each book, has its own style. But in Leviticus itself, quite commonly, and again, there's the whole thing about should we listen to the scholars in this field or not, but you can argue that in Leviticus itself, there are textual units. And if there are textual units, then you can go into this argument that even with that the text is going to use certain terminology, but the intent might be a little bit different than what you expect in other places. So the two possibilities why the term Shabbaton appears here. The first possibility of Shabbaton appearing here is imitating the language which appears later on about Yom Kippurim. I say imitating because this part kind of like hovers in a certain level of detachment from the rest of the text, and you'll see why. The other possibility is that it's an attempt to kind of link everything together by putting it, the word Shabbaton, here, and then repeating it again, which is a tool that's used at least one more time in this text of repeating certain words as a way of linking pieces to one another. There are basically three cases where things are repeated. The term Shabbaton, verse 2, these are the feasts of the Lord, and then in the story, in the description of Sukkot, where it kind of says the same thing again. If I remember correctly, let's go there for a second. It says in verse 37, Ele Moadei Adonai. So he repeats this phrase three times. So you can argue that the reason this phrase is repeated is because to link everything to one another. However, there's one time and it's done out of the three, which doesn't make any sense until you think about it. So it's quite possible the term Shabbaton here is not to equate Shabbat with Yom Kippurim, all forms of work, because all forms of work are forbidden, but Yom Kippurim has this elevated place inside the world of Torah. So it's just strange that Shabbaton appears, because by doubling the word, you've created more emphasis. So it says Mikra Kodesh. It is called a holy convocation. And again, using the term Mikra Kodesh here is a little bit of an abnormality because of the fact that it's a Shabbat. It's not a Mikra Kodesh, okay? Or you can argue it's not a Moed, to be more precise. Maybe you say Mikra Kodesh is okay. Kol melacha lo ta'asu, all forms of work you shall not do, repeating basically the beginning of the verse towards the middle. Shabbati la'adonai, to the Sabbath to the Lord, bechol moshvotechem, all your places of dwelling. So this term b'chol moshvotechem, all places of dwelling, the reason I say all places of dwelling is because there are people who go around trying to argue that if you're not in the land, you don't have to keep Shabbat. Now, if you want to link Shabbat to this entire description, which links all the feasts to one another, and the link between the feasts also has to do with the land, then you can argue that Shabbat is only to be kept in the land. However, it says Moshvotechem, your place of dwelling, not Artzechem, or terms that that may, for example, like we have in verse 10, Ki tavo el haaretz, when you enter the land. So it uses the word Moshvotechem, which means places of dwelling. Based on this, I want to argue that Shabbat is to be kept anywhere around the world. However, there are certain elements, there are certain things which appear that if they are directly linked to elements in the land, such as, for example, Pesach, which is linked to the idea of holding sheep and goats, okay? Which are part of the blessing of the land, so that has to be on the land. All the rest of the feast, everything has to do with the land. That's how Pesach, by the way, links to the land as well, because animals were considered to be part of the land itself, part of the blessing of the land itself. So Shabbat is a bit of an abnormality because it's global. It appears in Genesis 1. It has absolutely nothing to do with the land. It has absolutely nothing to do with the covenant with Abraham. It has absolutely nothing to do with space. It only has to do with time. So why is Shabbat mentioned here? Because Shabbat, and here's the logic, here is one of the reasons why Shabbat is here. We have to remember that the previous chapters, there was a link to the description of the Ten Commandments. There is a core idea. This is what Milgram points out. We spoke about this maybe 2-3 weeks ago. Milgram points out that most of the commandments, and I'll point out, by the way, I will say, by the way, that the rabbi said this a very, very long time ago. Every single commandment in the Torah can be linked to the Ten Commandments. So where do the feasts come from? The feasts come from keeping the Sabbath. That's where the feasts come from. The first day, which is dedicated to God, is Shabbat. And the rest of the feasts are a certain offshoot of Shabbat. So keeping true to the structure of the Ten Commandments, Leviticus is repeating the principle of these links by mentioning Shabbat here. So there's several things that happen here. Shabbat is not really part of the list. And the reason we know it's not really part of the list is because of verse 4. Verse 4 repeats this principle. It creates a block. It creates a new block separated from Shabbat by repeating the same principle which appears earlier. The opening in verse 2 has absolutely, I wouldn't say absolutely nothing, but really doesn't really have much to do with Shabbat. But by repeating Mikra Kodesh and Mikra Kodesh, it's mostly hinting to the idea that the feasts are an extension of Shabbat. Okay? So repeating certain words, repeating certain things is not by chance. This is done deliberately. Someone sat down here, obviously we're going to say it's Moses, someone sat down here and really thought about it, keeping true to larger structures which appeared in the text, and then going to smaller structures, but also linking things to one another by using specific terms or specific words. So Mikrai Kodesh, using the term Shabbaton, weaving all these pieces together into one larger structure, which is later on inside the feast. So let's see if there's any comments, questions. Okay, Kimberly asks, how are jobs in the medical field looked at in Judaism? Are medical personnel scheduled and paid to work on Shabbat? Okay, so medical people, emergency personnel and overall in Judaism are considered to be people that have to continue their work regardless. But what they do here, and they get paid for it as well, sometimes what they do is they do, for example, a religious person has to be in the police force, may opt out not to work on Shabbat, and then they have to kind of compensate their friends. Or if they do, they make that kind of, for example, I once made an agreement with someone that if I show up on Shabbat, then I don't get paid for it, but there's a legal issue there. So there's like this back and forth issue that exists inside this area. But I will point out that emergency services can be life threatening. Can be life threatening, and therefore people do go out and work. So they do get paid, they get scheduled and everything, which is something we prefer not to. But what they do is they minimize the personnel. So what we have is what's called Nohal Shabbat. It's what we call a Shabbat emergency plan, which basically means that less people have to work, and only if there's like a real emergency, then people are called in. They have special drivers who are not Jewish, who are commissioned to drive doctors and medical personnel to their homes, back and forth, basically pick them up, take them home Friday night, or pick them up on Friday evening, or what have you. Cindy Simmons says, the Kohen work on Shabbat, so studying is unto Adonai. I would think it would be acceptable to him. Studying is to God. So, you know, if a Kohen does his work on Shabbat, but there's a difference here. The work of the Kohen is not a profession. They're professional Kohanim. I mean, unlike, for example, like we mentioned last time, the priests in Egypt were usually non-professional personnel, where a person would volunteer for a while to be a Kohen. So you can argue that this is their profession, but it's not really their profession. They're professional Kohanim, but it's not the same as a profession. But a lot of the studying that I do, and overall is mostly to teach others and to increase the knowledge. So yeah, I mean, that argument is quite acceptable in my opinion, but I'm biased about this. So, you know, it's better to hear from others as well that can say that this is acceptable. Okay. Yes, it honors and glorifies his name, that I agree. His capital. Okay. So then we go to verse 4. And verse 4 starts again with the same thing. Ele moade Adonai. These are the appointed times of the Lord. Mikrai Kodesh. Holy convocations. Asher tikru otam b'moadam, which you will call them at their appointed time. Okay? You will call them at their appointed time is a very, very important statement. This statement, b'moadam, at their time. But then we have otam. Otam means them. There's a whole subject about the different functionality of the word et and how it's confused a lot of scholars of how to actually use it. It's kind of funny. I was reading a grammar book, and it's a grammar book I love using. It's a really, really wonderful grammar book. And the writer goes into this whole spiral of like, we don't really know what to do with the word et because it has like 2-3 different functions. And if there's a multi-function then of one word, then and we don't kind of can't really explain what it is. And then it goes into this whole, he rambles on for about 2 pages about, we don't know what to do with this. This is terrible. And at the end of the day, I mean, I look at it and go like, I kind of giggle to myself, kind of like, yeah, you know, just let it be. Let it be what it is. But Ota means them. And the verse really says, you will declare them. But when do you declare them? You declare them at their right time, when they're supposed to be, as I appointed it. And it goes into verse 5 and it says exactly when it's supposed to be. However, this verse was in the center of a massive controversy during the end of the first century, beginning of this of the second century, or the, probably the 90s of the first century, where people were still using testimony. There's this massive falsehood in Judaism today that people say, oh yeah, we have a calculated calendar from the beginning, it's always been like this. That's pure nonsense. One of the first people to actually say that was Rav Saadia Gaon, who wanted to argue that the calculation has always been in existence and this is the way it's supposed to be done, and the moon sighting is only like a secondary thing. As I said before in the past, Rav Saadia Gaon represents the beginning of, at least in my mind, the beginning of the distortion of Torah. As much as I admire his wisdom and everything that he did for Judaism, I perceive him as the first ultra-Orthodox Jew who doesn't necessarily try to understand what he's looking at and more trying to preserve what he's doing. And the problem with his claim, and this claim, by the way, is part of a massive argument that he had with one of the rabbis from the land of Israel in the 10th century, Ben Meir, who still sighted the moon. They were still sighting the moon in the 10th century in the land of Israel. This actually led the scholar, which right now is something Cohen, I think. No, not Shay Cohen. No, it's not Shay Cohen. It's some Russian name, Jewish scholar, but with a Russian name. To conclude that the calendar that we use today is only really about 800 years old. It's a relatively new thing, which is, by the way, correct. I mean, the moment I heard what he claims, I was like, no, that makes a lot of sense. But what appears in the Mishnah is this whole discussion about, you know, Rabban Gamliel II forcing his opinion on others, and a rabbi who figured out that the testimony that was received in the Beit Din, in the rabbinic council, which was, by the way, really only Rabban Gamliel and maybe other few rabbis. It wasn't the entire Sanhedrin. There's a great falsehood when it comes to this whole subject known as Sanhedrin. There's a lot of scholars who really deeply doubt, and I tend to agree with them, deeply doubt the Sanhedrin was a real thing, especially after the destruction of the temple, but ever. Was it really like the rabbis described? Was it really more revised history? Some things are revised history. It's pretty clear to me, at least. But some things are not necessarily. And in any case, the issue there was that to try to explain the authority of man over the calendar, Rabbi Akiva says to Rabbi Yehoshua. Rabbi Yehoshua was the rabbi who undermined Rabban Gamliel. He said to him, don't read it otam, read it atem, you, when you declare them. Therefore, if we declare them on a different time, it's still considered to be the feast. That for me today, as an historian, as a Bible scholar, as also a person who tries to seek the truth, is a breaking point. It's a breaking point where a rabbi steps in, undermines the not only the grammar, because not otam b'mo'adam, okay, using b'mo'adam links to otam, okay. If you say ashat tikru otam or tikru atem, without b'mo'adam, it would say okay, will you declare them? But when it says b'mo'adam, it says at their appointed time, linking these two words together, making them into a construction, clearly states that there's a specific time for them to be done. And in the ancient world, especially if you had a temple, if you change the date, you will anger the gods. And the Israelites understood the exact same way. If you don't do things at the right time, or you change something, you're in trouble. Now, for example, one of the most famous feasts that people try to link to the Feast of the Torah is the Akitu, which was a feast that they would do. Historically, the original one was done on the month of Tishrit, which is basically the seventh month. And then they added another one in Nisan, of the first month, to the biblical calendar because of certain logistics that they had and some issues that they were dealing with. But for them, for example, when Nebunaid, the last Babylonian king who was conquered in 539, he was basically, well, it wasn't really conquered. I mean, basically, he pissed off so many people in Babylon by going north into a territory and building a temple there and basically undercutting the temple of Babylon. They just surrendered the city to him. There was no battle. Just literally, there was no battle in Babylon. But what happened there was that you find in the letters that for about 10 years he wasn't in Babylon. And many scholars actually want to say that Nebunaid is actually the Nebuchadnezzar of the book of Daniel. The king who goes to exile for several years is like the animals of the field. They say that the reason the name Nebuchadnezzar is used there is because of something symbolic that symbolizes the kingship, because Babylon and Assyria were basically the same thing. There's two different cities, but very similar cultures. But they say that it was probably Nebunaid in that story, because Nebunaid was a king that went into exile to the desert of Tema. But in any case, and he came. There's a whole thing that he came back and he started changing everything. And he started changing the gods and everything. But In any case, one of the things that we find in the letters of the period actually state that the feast, especially the Akitu, has been disrupted for the last couple of years and not done at its right time or in the right manner, because it requires the king to be there. It wasn't done correctly, and it scared the Babylonians to bits. They were terrified by this. So if we take the logic of the ancient Near East to do things at the right time, at the appointed time, based on citing natural occurrences and everything, then if you are deliberately trying to change the calendar, or you are deliberately ignoring the rules of how a calendar is supposed to be, especially if it's a cultic calendar, you are in deep, deep, deep trouble. It was a very severe thing to do. Feasts were taken very seriously in the ancient Near East. So for me, historically, that's a massive breaking point inside Judaism. Today, if you ask me, it's a massive thing. And then it gets repeated again about 1,000 years later by Rav Saadia Gaon, who completely ignores how the calendar in overall works. In the Mishnah Talmud, they still accept that, okay, we cite the moon. You make a mistake, that's something else. You make a mistake, accidentally consecrate a day, the incorrect day, it's one thing. But to deliberately, knowingly say we're going to change the calendar, and in that story, there's a lot of politics as well. It's a very sad story in overall. But when you change this is a very severe thing. And then he goes in verse 5 and it says, Bahodesh Arishon, the first month, this is obviously the month of Aviv, Barba Asar Lahodesh, on the 14th to the month. Okay? So you count basically, see the new moon, next morning is the first day, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, go to 14, 14th morning, Ben Ha'arbaim, between the evenings. Now we've spoken about the term Ben Ha'arbaim, I wrote an article about it, we've spoken about this multiple times. The whole idea of Ben Ha'arbaim, the word Erev means the entry. We call it sunset, but they also arbu means to enter, between the entries. Now, this seems to be very clear. Arabic still maintains this. The Samaritans keep this the same way. Older Judaism did this exact same thing. No one ever had any doubt about this, that you have a timeline. You have a time between the setting of the actual disk of the sun and the setting of the light. Now, this day has always been an enigma to everyone in ancient Near Eastern cultures. It's light, but there's no sun. So how do we treat this? So for them, this was an enigma. So they treated both as part of the day before and part of the next day at night. So this is where the text says, the 14th after sunset, before darkness. But this ceremony begins at the sunset at the end of the 14th day. It's not really the 15th day yet, but you started and you have like a window during that time of the year, about 20 minutes before it actually goes dark. About 20 to 25 minutes. It depends where you live. For example, if you're high up, also the light continues to shine a bit longer. But if you're living in the valleys, it's a lot faster. Where I live, for example, which is a valley, during that time of year, about 20, 22 minutes into after sunset, it goes completely dark. But the whole idea is that you start there and you continue the ceremony into the night. And this is the problem. People get confused, like, when does this begin? The whole structure of time here in this chapter has always been in a lot of discussions with people. But in any case, the sun sets, you do this, and you continue into the night. Pesach l'Adonai, you pass over to the Lord. Now, the term Pesach itself, there are two common interpretations. One means to skip, because you have the term Pisach. A Pisach is a person who has a limp. So he kind of skips a step each time. So God skipped over the house of the Israelites. But then there's a verse in Isaiah where it says, Ganon pasoch v'hatzil, or something like that. Three words that basically means to protect. So people say it's a protective act. God protected these houses. And it really fits more into the description, putting the blood, in God's sin, and then putting the protect, because the destroyer was let loose in Egypt. It wasn't on a leash. So instead of skipping, the destroyer was let loose and God defended each one of the houses where people were keeping the Passover. And also putting blood is a protective act. It's a symbolic protective act. So you're not skipping, you're protecting. It's really what the blood is doing. And then it says, Uva hamisha asar yom lachodesh, on the 15th day of the month, basically the morning later, And how do you know that you start at the end of the 14th and it leaves on the 15th? Because of the link of the matzah. Eating on the, from the 14th night, matzah links you to the next day. Because I've literally met people who start on the end of the 13th day, and they do a Passover, and then they wait another day, and then they start the Chagat Matzah. I will point out, by the way, that scholars always try to detach the Passover and Chagat Matzah from one another, claiming these are two separate ceremonies. Milgonfer even goes into this whole theory that, you know, again, this has to do with Mendelhall. Mendelhall created a massive mess in the academic world when it comes to identifying social groups and everything. He made this argument, which today most people ignore. So if you ever see this in any scholarly work, especially if it's from, like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, if someone starts talking about, you know, the farmers versus the city dwellers, the herdsmen versus the land farmers and so on, if you ever see anything, anyone talk about that, just ignore it, because it's a theory that's never been proven as being real. Because herdsmen and farmers are people who were still dwelling in villages and cities. It wasn't, herdsmen were not just tent dwellers. No, there's a fact we know that people had, you know, we find animal pens in places that have to do with cities, or animal pens that have to do with villages and so on. So it's completely ridiculous. But they try to separate them from one another, claiming, oh, this happens here, this happened there. So, you know, I think that influenced a lot of the understanding that people have today, but also this time thing of the 14th into the 15th, because there was a lot of confusion. So V'hamisha asar yom l'chodesh is on the 15th day of this month, to indicate this is happening at the same time. Okay, because Pesach and Chag HaMatzot are technically two things. Okay? But they're happening more or less at the same time. Chag HaMatzot L'Adonai, Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. Shivat Yamim Matzot Tochelu, 7 days you will eat unleavened bread. Verse 7, Bayom HaRishon, the first day. So it's interesting the term Yom appears over and over again. It says it actually led a lot of people to understand that the main principle of when a feast is during the day, which is technically true because that's when you're awake, that's when you, it's usually when you do work, it's usually when you eat. So time of activity, okay? I will point out, by the way, the same principle follows in the temple as well. The temple starts its day during sunrise because, well, the temple really sees things only during the day. Nighttime, you don't do any ceremonies in the temple at nighttime. So the day, at least in Leviticus, is this consecrated time that the temple, the feast, the Shabbat, is really when things really happen, because at nighttime you don't do anything. Okay? So Bayom HaRishon, the first day, Mikra Kodesh Yelachem, a holy convocation will be to you. Kol Melechet Avodah Lo Ta'asu, any severe work you will not do. So it actually creates a separation between melacha in overall and melechet avodah. So melechet avodah, the way it's mostly understood is that it is a work that's physically taxing. So don't go do any field work and stuff like that. But it has led, especially if you go back to Exodus, was it 12, I think, either 12 or 13, where it says that, you know, you will do anything which is necessary to the person, you're allowed to do. So this is Leviticus. Let me just go there for a second with my Bible. Yeah, 12:16 says, on the first day will be a holy convocation, on the seventh day will be a holy convocation to you. Any work you shall not do. So in Exodus, he used the term melacha. He used the term melechet avodah. Ach asher yachel lecho nefesh, but that which will be consumed by any person, that alone shall be done to you. So you see that there's a certain element here. Here it doesn't state this end of verse 16, so it has to use the term melechet avodah. That's why the discrepancy between the two parts. It says melecha, but then there's things you are allowed to do. So you can use the term melecha in Exodus, but here, because it doesn't repeat this principle, then it says melechet avodah. Again, alluding back to what appears in Exodus. So lo ta'asu, shall not do. Vikratem ishel Adonai, and you will sacrifice a burnt offering, a gift. I mean, we have the whole issue of, is ishel related to the idea of burning, or is it to do with gift? To the Lord, shivat yamim, 7 days, b'yom ha-shevi'im mikra kodesh, on the seventh day, a holy convocation, Kol melechet avodah la ta'asu. Any severe work you shall not do. So there's any common questions, anything? Okay, I don't see anything else. Very good. Verse 9. V'daber Adonai Moshe le'emor, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Daber el b'nei Yisrael, speak to the children of Israel, v'amarta aleihem, and you'll say to them, Ki tavo el ha'aretz. Ki. Fascinating word. If you actually open up a lexicon, it will give you at least 4 or 5 definitions of what it is. But those who were with me when we were studying the book of Exodus know that ki is the opening, at least in the case of Exodus, the opening of a conditional clause in these cases. Especially when you're dealing with law, it opens up a conditional clause. Conditional clauses can be what's known as real or non-real. But when we say real or non-real, it's very important to point out that the reality or lack of reality of a clause has nothing to do with person telling the truth or lying. It has to do with is it something that's actually going to happen or something theoretical that may or may not happen? So even in the non-realistic clause, it's not the idea of it's not going to happen at all. It's just we don't know if it's going to happen. So here it says, Ki tavo el haaretz. So it really says, it doesn't translate as if. Okay, because the understanding of Leviticus is that we're going to enter the land, like the rest of the Torah. So you have to translate ki as when. Ki tavo el haaretz, when you enter the land. The root tavo comes from the root bo. Bo has been studied by several scholars, especially a scholar was reading a couple weeks ago. Bo, most people translate it as to come or arrive. But really, the majority of the cases really indicate, or many of the cases indicate, that it really means to enter. So for example, I wrote an article about this a couple of years back, but you know, when it says come to Pharaoh, go to Pharaoh, it really means enter before Pharaoh. I wrote this article probably in 2015 when I saw a rabbi kind of struggling, trying to explain what does it mean, come to Pharaoh, you know, what do we mean come? Why don't just go? What does it say? So he really went through this whole hula hoop of trying to explain it. But instead of saying, well, bo really has to do with the word mavo, which has to do with an entrance, which has to do with the idea of entering. So he says, when you enter the land, asher ani noten lachem, which I give to you. Again, this is going back to the whole subject of the covenant, but pointing out which I am giving to you. Remembering, this is not a right. This is a privilege. Uktzartem et ketzira, and you will harvest its harvest. And the root katzal, which is to harvest, comes to cutting something short. Because when you harvest, and this has to do with grain harvest, because grains were, you also say, why are grains being presented here? First of all, it's the first thing to ripen. But the other, also remember that grains, bread, lechem is the most basic food that people would eat. I mean, people eat vegetables and stuff like that, but when you sat down to have a real meal, one of the things that was expected to be on the table is bread. Eastern cultures eat everything with bread, well, except for other starchy substances. If you don't eat their rice, I mean, but in Mediterranean culture, if you're eating something which is not a grain, like for example, if you're eating couscous or rice or something like that, or cooked grains, you eat it with your hand. But when you're eating meat or vegetables, you have a flat bread and you basically eat with your hand. I have a friend, for example, got married with an Indian lady, and I finally got to see them as a married couple about a week and a half ago. This was, it was so important for me to go to visit the group because the couple there that I've known for quite a while and finally got married. But he told me about the whole thing, that he sits with his, now his Indian relatives, and everything's eaten with bread. You have, you know, chapati, or you have naan, or any one of these flatbreads, and you use it to scoop up your food. So this is another reason, because this is the main staple of food. The rest of items also come, but the idea here is not just food, but it's the idea of, you know, understanding where your food comes from. God gave you the land. God is the one giving you the food. What's also very interesting is that in studies that were done with very, you know, Neolithic cultures thousands of years ago, sharing your food with your God was something very, very basic that most of them would do because of the recognition of the importance of food, and the recognition of the gift of the food. Today, people, we live in an age of abundance. I mean, I know the 80s were considered to be a lot better than now because the economies were very strong. But we are living probably, historically speaking, probably one of the best, if not the best, period for mankind, because we have a pretty good control of disease. We have, at least in the developed countries and developing countries, there's food for everyone. We're so wealthy now that many of us are able to be fat, which was something which was unheard of in the ancient world, you know. So we kind of forget about where food comes from. I'm not saying you specifically as people here in the group, but society tends to forget, you know. So you have a thing like Black Friday and people have fist fights, you know, and I know you said earlier, but it represents, to me at least, forgetting where things come from. You know, 60 years ago, 50 years ago, people were starving. It's just a fact. So this, the feast, what they do is they remind us. It links us back to what happens in Leviticus, the curses and the blessings in Deuteronomy, constantly reminding us that we need to know where things came from, so we don't go into hubris, we don't over-exaggerate who we are. So it says, "Vehevetem omer reshit ketzirchem el hakohen." You will bring the first of the harvest, the sheaf. Now, the problem here with the term omer is that an omer can mean a sheaf, but the term omer itself is also a measurement. So it's quite interesting. For me, I would say naturally it has to do with harvest, so I would bring a sheaf. I would take the first sheaf and that would be it. However, the weight of an omer, especially in the Second Temple, seems to be larger than the space an omer would take. I think it's more of a weight, but an omer would take probably was higher in the Second Temple. So they had to actually bring a sheaf that was bigger. So in Second Temple, you hear this whole idea of bringing a weight of grain. But in the First Temple, they probably bought a sheaf itself. And there might have been a more or less average that you would get from a sheaf each time. There was probably a standardized size of a sheaf, and you were expected to bring that. I know each person has his own little sheaf, or one guy brings a tiny little sheaf, the other guy brings a gigantic sheaf. It was probably a standardized size, but we have to remember that omer is really a very precise amount. So it does raise the question, and I think legitimately raised the question during the Second Temple, am I bringing an actual sheaf, or am I bringing a weight known as an omer? So that's the whole thing by itself. But reshit ketzichem, the first of your harvest, from the first field that's ripened, for those who've been following me and Nehemiah Gordon for years, know that we look for the first place where there's enough barley to harvest. Now, how do we know it's barley? First of all, because it has to do with, it's the first of the harvest. This is literally what it is. But then we also have the whole issue with Chag HaShavuot, where you bring another type of bread, Lechem Tenufa. Now, barley bread wasn't really considered to be real bread. I mean, you usually fed barley to your animals, or if you were poor, this is what you did. But you ate barley. But here it's pretty clear that in the temple they mostly used wheat because that's what you offer your God. But because the first of the harvest represents the entire principle of eating food, and not necessarily the fine food that you offer to the rich and God, you can bring barley in. And also the whole thing of counting 50 days. There actually is more or less 50 days between one thing and the other. Milgram goes into this difficult corner where he says, well, I don't know why it's 50 days. Maybe each day they would say invocations to prevent destruction of the harvest and everything. So for 50 days, because 50 was also the Hamsin, the dry winds that would, because here in Israel we have, is when you move from, because we really only have winter and summer, we don't really have autumn. I mean, you never see autumn colors here in Israel. I mean, one of the things I always envy is, like, I've never actually seen autumn colors. We have a quasi-spring, but it's not really spring the same. What we really have here is like these sudden changes of weather. It suddenly goes, you know, winter ends, it's tend to get these heat spells, which are sometimes horrible. And then when we shift from winter to from summer to winter, you have sudden days where it just starts pouring with rain, and the next day it's shining and hot. So we don't, the way things gradually move is not as simple as you have, for example, in more northern, more southern countries. So he wants to say that, you know, they were praying that this dry, massive dry heat won't show up out of nowhere and destroy the harvest. It's a theory, but I don't think it really works. It says, v'henif et ha'omer, he would wave. It comes from the root hanef or nif or nuf. Different possibilities here, but henif, probably the henif is from the hif, so the hif is not part of the root. But he would wave the omer, lifnei Adonai Ratzonechem, before the Lord, to your appeasement. Remember, we saw the Tzonechem earlier as well in the sacrifices. It's that you will be accepted. You will be able to appease God when you do it before him. Lifnei Adonai, in Leviticus it seems that Lifnei Adonai means an entrance to the tabernacle. So either in front of the altar or in front of the entrance itself. Okay? Mimacharat ha-Shabbat yanifenu ha-Kohen. From the morrow of the Sabbath, the priest will wave it. Now, we spoke about what the morrow of the Sabbath is. I did a whole bunch of recordings about this and so on, so we don't really have to go into it. But the term Shabbat in Leviticus is isolated to days where you only don't do any form of work and really only fits the weekly Sabbath or Yom HaKippurim. This is obviously nothing to do with Yom HaKippurim. It has to be the weekly Sabbath. Verse 12, Vasitem bayom anifechem et ha'omer, and you will do, basically sacrifice, on the day that you are waving the omer, keves tamim, an unblemished sheep, ben shenato, or lamb, because it's ben shenato, the discussion is it in the first year or after 12 months? To me, I think this is in the first year. So this sheep will be a couple months old. There's a whole thing of how many litters they have, if they have a litter in the spring, a litter in the winter. So more or less, based on calculations I've seen, because I've actually seen natural litters, but you can actually manipulate how many litters a sheep would have, or goat. So I was trying to figure out what was the natural litter. I mean, when did they usually give birth? And it hasn't really been clear. I've asked around, and some people made the argument that the natural litter is more towards the summer, and some other person went to argue it's more somewhere towards the end of winter. I know it's there's manipulation here, but the one thing I can say is that regardless, this animal is going to be less than a year old. Le'olah la'Adonai, as a burnt offering to the Lord. This, by the way, is relevant also to the Passover. We had the whole discussion of Passover. I have an article called "How Old Am I?" and I kind of bring that in. Uminchato, and it's grain offerings. The term mincha is usually a gift given from someone lower to someone higher. But the term mincha here in the lexicon of Leviticus is also a grain offering. Shene esronim solet, 2/10 of the ephah of solet. Solet, today when people use the term solet, we spoke about this before, and there was a whole funny discussion I had with my boss years ago. Solet is fine flour. It's after the process of silut, which is putting it through a sieve. So solet means white or whitish flour. It's not the yellow stuff that you get after that people use to make cakes and stuff like that. Belulav ha-shemen, mixed with oil. Ishel Adonai, a burnt offering to the Lord. Reach nichoach, an appeasing aroma. The whole discussion, why is it an appeasing aroma? You're burning something. How is it an appeasing aroma? Venisco, and the liquids that you give with it, the libation. Yain, wine. Now, wine here, it's usually red wine. That's the basic wine that they would have. Revi tahin, a quarter of the hin, which is really small quantity, because the hin is about, I think it's like a third of a gallon or something like that. So this is a ninth of a gallon, maybe. Basically, someone said to me about the size of the average can that you would drink. By the way, the wine they used to have back then wasn't really high quality. This is usually rushed wine. It would be a wine that maybe fermented for a couple of weeks and maybe kept in a jar for a couple of months. But this wasn't high quality wine. Velechem and bread, vekali and roasted, because from kala, roasted grains, vecharmel. Charmel is probably soft grains that you can eat as they are. So you're going, you're digressing from fully processed to half processed to nothing. Lo tochlu ad etzem ha'mazi. We'll not eat until this very day. Etzem means bone, but here means very, the actual thing. So it's interesting, the man, a human being is really his bones, because that's what survives after a person dies. On this very day, hayom hazeh. By the way, eating charmel or karmel, one of the things that comes up usually when we do the Aviv search is, can you taste it to see the quantity of starch? Now, I've done this multiple times in front of people, where, because I learned this from a friend of mine who grows barley and wheat, that you can actually tell if it's ready or how close it is by tasting one and chewing on it. And so, you know, I chewed, it was nice, I swallowed it. So, oh, you're eating before the harvest and everything. I said, no, it's not the same thing. Because I'm chewing this and testing it is very different than picking up and eating large quantities. I'm taking one and tasting. I don't think it's the same thing. But, you know, he wanted to spit it out. I said, fine. Ad aviyachem, until you bring et korban Elohechem, until you bring the sacrifice of your God. Chukat olam ledorotechem, an eternal law to your generations, which means that even, and this is what today in Rabbinic Judaism we practice this, even if you don't bring the sacrifice, today we don't have the ability to bring the sacrifice because there's no temple, at least people are insisting not to build a temple, you have to wait until after the day of the waving to harvest and eat new grain-based foods. Okay? Bechor moshvotechem, all your places of dwelling. Now, again, inserting all your places of dwelling makes it to do with the land. Okay? Going back to what we had in verse 3, why does it say all your places of dwelling here? Again, it links it to this place. However, you can argue, and I've seen people argue, like, look, it's this is to do with the land. This must do with the land as well. So Shabbat is only in the land. But is it possible that Bechol Moshevotechem is, again, another mechanism like Shabbat Shabbaton? Just dawned on me now. And the same thing as Mikra Kodesh is all ways of linking Shabbat as the father, mother, uncle, sister, brother, and everything of the feast. So is it possible it's added here and maybe in other places as well? Bechol Moshevotechem, it's used. You know, can you argue that Yom Kippurim is only in the land? So if I fly out of the land, I cannot fast in Yom Kippurim? I highly doubt it. So it seems to me that there's a weaving here of terms and principles and words that kind of link everything to one another. Okay. Let's see if there's any comments. Is this saying that everyone with a barley field brings an omel? That's a very, very debatable subject. Some people say yes, some people say no. Some scholars say that there's a symbolic, main symbolic one that's bought, but then if each person wants to bring one, they can. I don't know. I just don't know. I've tried to find absolute answers with this one, but I just don't have one. So maybe that's how they get the weight from individual sheaves. I doubt that the individual sheaves is how they get the weight. I mean, you bring a sheaf, you may, because if you remember that the whole idea is that an omer, I mean, the omer itself, the historical meaning of the term is the sheaf. So there probably was an average that you get out of the sheaf itself. No. know, so I don't think bringing the several sheaves together is really what will give you the weight. I don't think that's correct. Okay, so I'm going to close this up. So today was the 26th of November 2017.